This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about a favorite subject of mine, which is nursing, because I'm married to a nurse, and all our friends almost are nurses, or husbands of nurses anyway. With me to talk about the politics and dynamics of nursing is Suzanne Gordon, who's written several books on the subject. She's a visiting professor at the University of Maryland School of Nursing, and she's the editor of a new book entitled When Chicken Soup Isn't Enough, Stories of Nurses Standing Up for Themselves, Their Patients, and Their Profession. Suzanne Gordon, welcome back to Progressive Radio.
Thank you for having me again, Matt.
It's always great to talk with you and to read what you've been writing and to focus in on this underappreciated field of nursing. You've been writing about nurses now for 20 years.
More than
20 years. Why this focus?
Well, I'm actually not a nurse. My father was a famous doctor, and I grew up not having a clue about what nurses do in a culture that has a kind of amnesia about nurses. And I went to the hospital to have a baby, and my very good friend, who is a wonderful obstetrician, was there to take care of me, but I thought she would be there during the whole time. And lo and behold, it was the nurses who were there and who really got me through the labor and the next 4 days of learning how to take care of my baby. And my doctor, who's my friend, was great and did critical things, but really nurses were absolutely essential. And I realized that I didn't really know anything about nurses. I mean, I kind of knew they existed, but that was pretty much it. And I spent the last 25 years finding out more about what nurses do and writing. I think I've written 7 books about nurses and nursing in one way or another.
And you haven't got tired of it? It continues to interest you?
No, I really find it fascinating. I keep thinking every once in a while I get frustrated and think, you know, I have to write about something else. And then I get dragged into some topic related to nursing or whatever. And it really is endless, you know, because nursing is very rich and dynamic, and school nurses are different from ER nurses are different from nurse practitioners are different from bedside nurses in a medical floor. You know, it's all different. And there's all these aspects of nursing, doctor-nurse relationships, nurse-nurse relationships, nursing in the public, which is you know, you could write 100 books on each topic.
And one of the themes of your books about nursing, Suzanne Gordon, is that nurses are underappreciated, that they're stereotyped as being kind, kind of handholders, back patters, but that their expertise, their skill,
their knowledge,
their insight, their observational and diagnostic abilities are neglected or totally erased.
And also one of my themes is that nurses themselves erase this, that they tend to focus on part of the story of what nurses do. And this new book, When Chicken Soup Is Enough, is taking on that part of nursing and what nurses say about themselves and what is kind of fed to nurses that in really encourages them to present themselves not in the serious, to do the serious, as people who do the serious work that they do, but as kind of handholders and fretters and, you know, hearts and flowers. I mean, nursing imagery is filled with hearts and saints and angels. And nurses perpetuate this very traditional image without knowing and understanding, I think, the consequences of how that impacts their ability to deliver good patient care.
Why do you think they do that, Suzanne Gordon?
Because I think that nursing grew out of religious work. It began not on the battlefields of the Crimea with Florence Nightingale, but in about 100 years after the birth of Christ. It was penitential work. Nurses were part of religious orders, and they were trained to be self-sacrificing, self-effacing. And nursing has continued that legacy in the 19th century with Nightingale and nurse reformers. Nurses were battling patriarchal attitudes. And so to get into the hospital, to get out of the home and into the hospital, nurses had to get around some of the prejudices against women's intelligence and so forth. And that has, in a way, continued. And nurses have been continually in a subordinate, put in a subordinate position that they shouldn't be in with physicians. So sometimes to manage this complex relationship, they have to pretend that they don't know as much as they know. I mean, it's kind of like when I was a kid in the 50s, you know, my mother would wanted me to go out a lot, but she also, you know, oh, good, you have a date. That's great. But don't let them know how smart you are, you know, because then they'll run away from you. And I think that that's a game that nurses have continued to play and often are put in a position of playing and encouraged to play.
And it's a combination of the sexual division of labor there. I mean, this is an old and division of labor that hasn't really changed that much. It's so predominantly female, so you have society sexism on top of the hierarchy of doctor-nurse.
Well, what's really interesting, Matt, is that nursing until the 19th century, mid-19th century, was done pretty much by half men and half women. From, you know, the time of when organized nursing started 100 years after the birth of Christ until the mid to late 19th century, nursing had a lot of men in it. And the Nightingale reformers were trying to help women who were displaced from the home by industrialization and urbanization find paid, purposeful work outside the home, and they really feminized nursing. Nurses, male nurses, men as nurses were not allowed to register in the late 19th century when the registration of nursing started, and that lasted pretty much until after the Second World War, I think. And so nursing was not always a female profession. And what's interesting in nursing is now that, I mean, there is clearly gender factors do apply. But when you look at female doctors are socialized to function like the male doctors before them. Male nurses are socialized to function like female nurses have functioned. So it's very interesting gender dynamics. And I think that you've constantly got to remind nurses to tell a different story, you know, to talk about their brains as well as their hearts, to talk about what they do, not just what they feel.
And I think anyone who's been around nurses for a long time understands the variety of things that nurses do and that they use their brains all the time. And sometimes they use their brains to save lives and to correct errors that their superiors and their doctors are making. I mean, you can go into any hospital in America, anywhere in the world probably, and if you asked a nurse who's been on the job there 10 years, she would tell you which doctors not to go to if you had a problem.
Well, and not only which doctors not to go to, but what is the status of nursing in that institution? I mean, if you can have the best neurosurgeon in the world, you can have the best doctor, but if there's, you know, if you get that great neurosurgery from that great neurosurgeon and there's neurosurgical nurses are taking care of 8 patients or 6 patients or maybe even sometimes 5 patients when instead of 3 or 4, or if an ICU nurse and a neuro ICU is taking care of 3 patients instead of 1 or 2, you know, that, and if she isn't an expert and if there isn't expertise, if there isn't the right balance between new nurses and veteran nurses, then you're going to be in trouble.
You've talked about this nurse-patient ratio in prior books and in this book, Suzanne Gordon, and you mentioned the California Nurses Association and the work that they've done to lower the patient-nurse ratio by law there.
Right. In the book, When Chicken Soup Isn't Enough, there are 2 stories from nurses who fought the fight in California. And one is Vicky Bermudez, who, when Governor Schwarzenegger attacked and suspended the ratios that were supposed to be implemented starting in 2004 and 2005, and the ratios were 1 patient for 6 nurses in 2004 on medical surgical floors, and then it went to 1 to 4 in 2005.
One nurse for six patients,
1 nurse for 5, and the California Nurses Association wanted 1 to 3, but the California Hospital Association wanted 1 to 10, mm-hmm. if you can believe it. I mean, that's like incomprehensible. And And Schwarzenegger declared an emergency suspension of the ratios, and the CNA took them to court, and this nurse was in charge of that court case. And there was another nurse in the book, Kelly DiGiacomo, who's a small nurse who was trailing Schwarzenegger around along with his band of nurses. And he basically, she went to a premiere in Sacramento where he was attending with Travolta, John Travolta and Uma Thurman. And she went in her scrubs, this little nurse, you know, what goes into the premiere in her scrubs just to see what the governor is going to say, and is basically escorted out by these two burly highway patrolmen, interrogated for an hour. And then the media got a hold of it. And Schwarzenegger really got a bad name because, you know, the big bodybuilder Terminator was afraid of this little nurse. But, you know, Matt, you talk about, I mean, the kind of expertise that nurses bring, and why do they need the appropriate staffing ratio? I mean, there's a story in the book that's one of my favorites about an ER nurse in Arizona where they don't have any ratios, and she's got a patient who's basically taking who has a heart problem, and the doctor prescribes blood thinners, and then the doctor leaves, and she's talking to the guy and discovers that he's taking an over-the-counter vitamin supplement that actually thins the blood, and he's using it because of his eyes. He's got vision problems. And she recognizes that if this guy takes this med, which he's been taking, so it's in his system, and if he takes the blood thinner, he's going to have retinal hemorrhages and go blind. And she basically calls the doctor up and says, "Excuse me, doctor." And he goes, oh my God, I didn't realize that. Don't have him take the med. Well, I mean, imagine if she'd had more patience, if she couldn't take the time to talk to that guy. So, you know, the hospitals are saying, oh, ratios, we don't need them. It'll cost too much money. Well, it would have cost a heck of a lot more money if that guy had had retinal hemorrhages and gone blind than it would to have the appropriate ratio of nurses so that a nurse can pay attention to those kind of details.
And she was just doing her job very well. She was attentive. She was doing a good case history. She was attending to what the patient was telling her about his symptoms.
Right. And she was also saying, "Excuse me, doctor." She mm-hmm. was advocating. I view this new book as really a collection of 73 stories of nurses in all walks of nursing. I mean, there's chief nurse executives, there's nurse managers, there's bedside nurses, home care nurses, ER nurses, nurse researchers. And basically, these are people who really put advocacy into action. In other words, it's their definition of advocacy isn't, I hope things go well for you, I'm out of here. Their definition of advocacy is calling out, defending a position, making some kind of public statement, even if the public is a doctor, another nurse, a principal investigator on a study, whatever. I think you see this, the kind of breadth of advocacy in the stories that these nurses tell in their own voices.
And Suzanne Gordon, in this book, when chicken soup isn't enough, you're trying to expand the definition of nurse advocacy, because you say that advocacy is kind of a buzzword in the nursing profession.
Right.
It means you've got to advocate as a nurse for your patient. And you're suggesting that nurses need to advocate for themselves, too, and for
Absolutely.
Good public policy.
Absolutely. When people have read the subtitle of the book, which is Stories of Nurses Standing Up for Themselves, Their Patients, and Their Profession, they've often said to me, well, why did you put themselves in, or why didn't you put themselves last, you know? And I put it in, and I put it in first very deliberately, because nurses are always asked to sacrifice themselves to their patients. And most often they do, and they do it too readily, and there's no limit to their self-sacrifice. And I think nursing, medicine, I mean, any public profession like that involves a certain amount of willingness to set your own needs aside. I mean, if a patient is crashing, you know, you're not going to go get lunch, right? If a patient is having a cardiac arrest. But nurses are asked to go way beyond that, to never go to the bathroom, to never eat. I mean, we treat our cars better than we treat nurses. You know, when the car runs out of fuel, you get gas. Well, guess what? Food is the fuel. I mean, there's a reason why we eat every 6 hours. It's because the tank is empty, you know, and you got to fill it up. And we ask nurses to go without lunch breaks, without coffee breaks, work a 12-hour shift, and never go to the bathroom. And we ask them to lift, 300-pound patients without any lift equipment. And I think nurses have to say no to those unreasonable demands for self-sacrifice. So there's all these stories in this book about, for example, nurse Martha Baker in Florida, who works with her union to get lift equipment in the hospital so that she won't, her nurses, the nurses she represent, won't have to lift, 400-pound patients. You can't lift anything over 100 pounds, over 50 pounds safely, which is how come we can't have UPS drivers can't pick anything up over 50 pounds. Nurses are asked to lift, turn, reposition patients who are not only, over 50 pounds, but who are essentially dead weight. And actually, if what you discover is if a nurse is turning, repositioning, lifting a patient, and the patient is dead weight and they're more than 50 pounds, basically you're going to drag the patient, you're going to shear their skin, you're going to set them up for a very expensive and excruciating bed sore, you're going to drop the patient. So often it turns out that what is good for the nurse is also good for the patient.
You also have some stories here, some funny stories,
yes.
Suzanne Gordon, about nurses organizing and using their collective bargaining strength. I mean, it's often when nurses go on strike, people would say, how can you do that? How can you do that for your patients?
Right.
And then the one case in here that made me laugh was, of course, there was an instance where there was negotiating going on at the bargaining table over pensions.
Yes.
Why don't you tell that story?
Well, this is a great story. It happened in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and the person who's the writer is Candace Alley, who's the president of the Wisconsin Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals, and she was in negotiations with the hospital that was owned by the biggest hospital, part of the biggest hospital system in the state. And they were in negotiations, as you say, about pensions, and the hospital system wanted to cut the nurses' pensions, and the CEO was making millions and had millions in retirement, and they, these poor nurses, their pensions were going to be cut. And she said to the chief negotiator for the hospital as they were walking out of the room one time, it's really outrageous what you're trying to do to these nurses. You're taking any kind of semblance of security away from them when they're older. And he says to her, if nurses wanted to have security in their old age, they should have married well. Well, they faced with that comment, they could have thrown a hissy fit, done whatever. But instead, they were incredibly clever. And they went out and scoured the secondhand stores of Milwaukee, and they got bridal gowns and veils, and they rented a bus, and they all dressed up, these middle-aged nurses in these bridal gowns, and put veils under their nurse's cap, and they had a big banner to the CEO of this healthcare system, and they went to corporate headquarters with this banner saying, "Marry me." And they got a ton of press, and even that didn't embarrass them, and then they kept on going. They had banners, they had radio, spots, and did more education, and they eventually got one. But I love that story because it's a story of how you can be really clever. There's a story, another story I love, that was written by a school nurse in Wichita, Kansas. And, school nurses really are very overlooked, and they're really incredible, and they have all kinds of problems to deal with. You name it, they got it in their school.
And it's not just Band-Aids and eye tests anymore.
It is so beyond Band-Aids and boo-boos and eye tests, So this nurse is a principal notifies her that he wants to cut back the hours in the school, and she says, well, what kind of kids with what kind of problems? And, do you have kids with asthma? And he says, yes. And, I guess we can delegate inhalers to somebody who's not a nurse. And what about epilepsy? Do you have anybody with epilepsy who's taking this medicine called Diastat, which controls seizure, and has to be, it's a rectal medicine. So he says, yes, we do have a kid. And she says, you may be asked to administer this Diastat for this kid rectally. And she explains what that entails. And the guy gasps and says, oh, I remember there's some money that I just forgot, And basically they get the hours for the school nurse. So, this is very clever. And sometimes you have to just kind of say, you can't do that. And sometimes you have to really be smart. And nurses do that all the time.
And there's also the case, Suzanne Gordon, you have the nurses writing up their own cases in this.
Well, they're all, this is all written by nurses in their own voices.
Yes, and that's neat. And there's this one nurse who said she was just going to call in sick if they didn't get better equipment to help with
patient
people who are disabled,
walking.
I think. Yeah.
Right. They said that they wanted this nurse to help this patient walk at night. And she said, well, it's not safe for me or the patient to do it without a Mary Walker. But the Mary Walker was locked up in a cabinet, and they didn't want to call the security person to come and open it. And she basically said, you know, I'm going to just call in sick or go out sick. And guess what? You know, they opened up and they got the Mary Walker. But that's why you have to stand up for yourself, because it often, you know, some nurses have taught, oh, well, you know, it doesn't matter. You can lift the person. You can walk the person. You need to do that. No. You know, it's like going on strike. I mean, I don't think nurses, I think no person who's in a union wants to go on strike ever. But, you know, sometimes you have to say no, because if you don't say no, you perpetuate the noxious circumstances, and then things are really bad for your patients. And in various ways, people in this book are either saying no or keeping on going or saying, no, that's not good enough. And they're often saying no to this, and, well, there's a yes, there's a solution here, but we have to fight for it.
You also talk about some problems among nurses themselves. You have a chapter called Eating Our Young, or that
expression
is in there.
Well, there's a whole chapter called, I think there's a whole section about nurse-nurse relationships. And one of the stories I like the best is a nurse in Maryland, Clola Robinson Blake, who has been a nurse for about 20 years and has experienced people when she was a new nurse or when she was working in a new place being very unwelcoming, you know, oh, she's too slow, oh, she's this, she's that. And she vowed that she would never act that way to nurses she was mentoring. And so she was working on a unit, and there was a new grad who came on, and people were very, you know, nurses have, when you're very burdened, and also I think just as a species, we tend to mark territory as opposed to welcome the new person. You know, it's like we're going to put them in their place, right? And nurses are no different from any other human being. And so this, people were complaining about this new nurse. She's too slow. You know, she's this, she's that. And Clola went to the manager and said, you know, look, I actually think she's slow because she just got out of nursing school. And what do we expect? And it's our job to help her learn. And people are being too negative. And I think that we need to support her. And the manager said, you know, you're right. And they had a big meeting. And then they not only supported this nurse, but they developed a whole new way of mentoring and welcoming new nurses onto the unit.
Yeah, I hadn't realized, Suzanne Gord, that was just kind of a cliche in the nursing
Absolutely. Business. Nurses eat their young. And believe mm-hmm. me, they don't just eat their young, you know. And mind you, I mean, nurses, I think, tend to think that they have a special lock on bad behavior towards one another. I mean, doctors also can be pretty mean to each other. I mean, I once knew an internist who said about an orthopedist, you know, who had brain surgery and had brain damage as a result, oh, well, he's just an orthopod, you know, like he doesn't really need his brain, right? So we can be kind of nasty to each other unless we really remind ourselves that we need to really be more welcoming and more supportive of one another.
You have a nurse writing about welcoming a young resident. This is an old nurse teaching a young doc basically how to attend to a patient and listen to a patient. And I love that little chapter because she was saying, look, I've got gray hair, you're young.
Oh, right, exactly, right.
You know, I'm only going to be here for a couple more years.
Yes.
You're going to be here a long time.
Right.
Maybe you should,
right.
That, you know, we should learn right. to work together, and maybe I can help you.
And what she was trying to do, he was a surgeon, and she was trying to get him to call palliative care in on a patient who was terminal. And he basically said to her, you know, my job is to fix her neck. Her neck is fixed. I'm out of here. And she said to him, instead of like either like getting frustrated and storming away or venting to somebody else, she sort of put her hands on his shoulders and said, look at my gray hair. You know, I hope that I can convince you that palliative care is important to patients. And the next day he came to her and said he talked to the attending about palliative care. I mean, you know, it's funny, Matt, when I wrote the book, I had this idea in mind ever since the Chicken Soup for the Nurse's Soul books came out, and I began reading them, and I thought, you know, these stories are just so sappy and saccharine, and they just, you know, yeah, they're well-intentioned and they try to celebrate nurses, but what do they celebrate them for? For holding hands, for worrying, for praying, for believing in ghosts, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I feel that that narrative is really disempowering to nurses. It silences them because it's part of the sugar and spice message that, you know, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it. And I've always had this phrase in my head, when chicken soup isn't enough. Well, what do you do when chicken soup isn't enough? And hey, I'm Jewish, you know, I'm a big believer in chicken soup, so don't get me wrong. But when I put out the call for these stories and I got these stories, you know, it was very much a kind of potluck. I mean, obviously I selected some weren't, didn't make it. They weren't the right kind of story. And I'm impressed by the stories of these nurses, because this book is their book. It's not my book. You know, I'm just giving them the opportunity to speak of how nurses at all these different levels, whether they're a bedside nurse or a chief nurse executive or a nurse researcher with PhD and all these fancy letters after their name, how they have similar problems and how, if they're going to do their work effectively, they have to deal with getting around these obstacles. And there's all different kinds, but they all face obstacles.
And in some cases, the nurse is aware that the doctor is basically killing his patients. There are at least two stories in here about it, one from Australia with Dr. Death. That's an incredible story.
Oh, that was such an incredible story. I heard about that story when I was in Australia, and Tony Hoffman should get, you know, the Nurse of the World Award. I mean, this is a story where she's a nurse in a nurse manager in a rural hospital in Queensland, which is in northern Australia, and there's a surgeon who comes from the States, from Oregon, and suddenly patients start dying. He takes on surgeries in this small hospital that would have been referred to a larger medical center. Patients die. People who didn't need surgery suddenly get cut up in pieces, as it were, and they die. And she starts complaining about this, and she, you know, goes to the administrators, but he's kind of buttered up the administrators. They go to members of parliament, to politicians, the Queensland Medical Association attacks her. Everybody attacks her. Finally, she goes to a journalist. The journalist does what nobody had ever done, which was Google the guy, and discovers that in Oregon, he lost his license, that he had worked for Kaiser in one setting and was one of the most sued doctors there. She just persisted. He fled back to Oregon. He was extradited. Members of parliament lost their seats. The administrators lost their positions. And this woman fought for her patients, no matter what the risk, and she won. There's a section of the book called Still Fighting, because, and this was, again, a part of the book that some people said, oh, why do you have this? You know, you should have stories where everybody wins and there's a happy ending. And I said, you know, no, real advocacy means persisting even when you don't win, even when you have to keep on fighting. And I think those people are real, real serious advocates who we need to recognize as well.
And in that section, there's an analogous situation that wasn't so happy, in that a nurse was saying, this doctor's doing terrible surgeries. He's going to kill one of these kids. He did very early.
He killed 12.
Surgeries on very young babies. And ultimately, her nightmare came true, and she saw him kill a baby in the operating room.
Well, she saw him, unfortunately, killed 12. I mean, this was not – the guy in Australia was, I think, pretty nuts. This guy was just over his head. But again, these nurses were – you know, I hope nurses will not only read this book, I hope they'll give it to doctors, to policymakers, to CEOs, because this shows what nurses can do and why won't we let them do it.
It is a great book. Suzanne Gordon's been my guest. The book is When Chicken Soup Isn't Enough. Suzanne Gordon, great to talk to you again.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.